From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Chinese court orders Japanese boats seized for wartime compensation. Ukraine looms over Obama trip to Asia. China's largest auto show is underway. We'll see what's driving interest this year. These stories and more on this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. A court in Shanghai has ordered the seizure of a Japanese ship as reparation for a debt dating back to the 1930s. The move is considered the first confiscation of Japanese assets in a lawsuit over wartime compensation. Rebecca Valley in Hong Kong has more for VOA.
The Shanghai Maritime Court had previously ordered Japanese shipping firm Mitsui O.S.K. Lines to pay close to $30 million for having lost two ships its predecessor, Daido Kaiyun, rented from a Chinese company in 1936. During World War II, the Japanese government expropriated the ships, which later sank at sea. On Sunday, the court announced that it had seized the container ship Baosteel Emotion, stationed in Zhejiang Province. It said that if Mitsui does not pay its debt, the vessel will be disposed of according to the law. Relations between Japan and China have been strained in recent years by territorial disputes and growing nationalism. Monday, Japanese Foreign Minister Fumio Kishida protested the Shanghai court's decision and warned of future diplomatic and economic fallout.
1972年のこの日中のこの共同声明
He says that this could even threaten the spirit of the part of the 1972 Japan-Sino joint statement which normalized diplomatic relations between Japan and China. He added that he also feels a deep anxiety that economic activity between Japan and China will shrink because of this. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says the case is just a regular business contract dispute and has nothing to do with wartime compensation. More than 40 years ago, Japan and China signed an agreement to normalize relations. In it, China renounced its demands for war reparations from Japan in the interests of the friendship between the Chinese and the Japanese peoples. The provision has caused controversy over the years, as people in China have attempted to seek compensation for crimes such as forced labor, sexual slavery, and lost assets. Lawsuits filed in Japan have been rejected, and Chinese courts have also been reluctant to accept such cases. In a recent rare case, a court in Beijing accepted a lawsuit on behalf of Chinese laborers exploited by Japanese companies during World War II. Liu Jiangyong, a professor of China-Japan relations at Beijing's Tsinghua University, says that such litigation does not contradict China's diplomatic agreement with Japan. He says while the Chinese government has forfeited the right to ask for reparations, there are legitimate demands from individuals who suffered losses during the war. He says the Japanese government and the companies who at the time caused the injuries should give compensation according to the law and in a humanitarian spirit. This is not a war reparation, he says. This would be a civil compensation with wartime as the background of the offense. Many in China believe that the Japanese government has not atoned for the abuses perpetrated during its militarist past. On Monday, in a move strongly protested by China, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe sent ritual offerings to the Yasukuni Shrine. The monument honors Japanese war dead, including 14 convicted World War II war criminals. Rebecca Valley reporting for VOA News in Hong Kong.
Later on Daybreak Asia, a push to keep Pakistani girls in school by curbing child marriages. President Barack Obama's trip to Asia this week comes as concerns about Beijing's territorial ambitions are growing in the region. Those concerns have been compounded by Russia's recent actions in Ukraine and the possibility that Chinese strategists might be looking to Crimea as a model for its territorial disputes with its neighbors. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Ukraine may seem far removed from events unfolding in one of the world's most dynamic regions, a key driver of the global economy. But it is clearly on the minds of U.S. officials. Speaking at a security conference in Indonesia last month, Admiral Harry Harris, commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, talked about the need for all countries in the region to work to avoid a Crimea-type situation in the Pacific. Earlier in April, Daniel Russell, Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, told U.S. lawmakers that sanctions the U.S. and European Union placed on Russia should have a chilling effect on anyone in China who might be thinking about using Crimea as a model. He also said that sanctions put pressure on China to show it is committed to peaceful resolution of its disputes in the region. Over the past 2 years, China has put increasing pressure on Japan. Jean-Pierre Cabestan, a political scientist at Hong Kong Baptist University, says there is clearly a temptation for Beijing to try and alter the status quo. But he adds, there are big differences between China's disputes in Asia and what has happened on the Crimean Peninsula.
For one thing, Japan is a U.S. ally. There is a security treaty between Japan and the U.S., which compelled the U.S. to intervene. And China knows it, I think even more so today, because the U.S. Obama administration has sent a number of very clear signals to China that the U.S. would be involved in any armed conflict around the Senkaku.
When it comes to the dispute over uninhabited islands in the East China Sea, known as the Senkakus in Japan and Diaoyu Islands in China, Beijing's options are limited. Japan controls the islands, and attempts to even land on them in the past by Chinese activists have not lasted long. Xie Tao, a political scientist at Beijing Foreign Studies University, says if the Chinese government was to support some sort of effort by fishermen or others to land on the islands for a period of time and then proclaim sovereignty, that could backfire.
Everybody knows that it cannot sustain any long-term, human settlement. And if you do that, that's obviously a trap set by the Chinese government. And that will only incur, international condemnation and international criticism.
The United States says it does not take sides in the disputes, be it in the East or South China Sea. But Washington's efforts to rebalance its position in the region by shoring up diplomatic, economic, political, and security ties has raised concerns in China. Some here see that effort, or pivot to Asia as it is called, as an attempt to contain Beijing's rise. China says it is seeking to peacefully resolve its disputes in the region and has accused Japan of hyping regional threats to justify its military expansion. Japan will be the first stop on President Obama's four-nation tour of the region, which includes visits to South Korea and to other Southeast Asian nations that have territorial disputes with China in the South China Sea, the Philippines, and Malaysia. Last year, a government shutdown in Washington forced President Obama to cancel his attendance at the APEC Leaders Summit. Cabestan says this year's trip is part of an effort to pick up from where he left off.
President Obama wants to repair his non-participation to the APEC Summit in Indonesia in the fall last year, because it gave the occasion for China to sort of run the show in place of Obama.
The stop in Malaysia will be the first for a U.S. president in nearly five decades and comes at a time when relations between Kuala Lumpur and Beijing are under tremendous strain following the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook, VOA Asia. And one of the interesting stories out of China today is the Chinese auto show. Leading automakers taking part in this year's Beijing International Automotive Exhibition, going on now through April 29th. It's China's largest auto show, which features more than 1,100 vehicles. General Motors, Ford, Toyota, Volkswagen, and Hyundai are among the global manufacturers taking part. At Sunday's Media Day, Ford CEO Alan Mulally sounded upbeat about the role of his company can play in China's economic growth.
Well, we're very positive about the Chinese economy. I mean, they had a target around 7.5. It looks like it's coming in at 7.4 now. But clearly, the focus in China on economic development for the good of everybody is fantastic. And also, you know, we feel like we're really part of the solution because we're contributing to the economy, also energy independence and security, and environmental sustainability with our great sustainable vehicles. So we're very positive about the economy, not only now, but also going forward.
Ford introduced its line of Lincoln products aimed at the luxury car buyer. The company's China operations plans to open up 8 Lincoln retail outlets in 7 Chinese cities, including Beijing and Shanghai, in October. Ford aims to boost its stores to 60 across China in 50 cities by 2016. And meanwhile, rival General Motors says it plans to invest $12 billion over the next 3 years and expand sales up to 10% alone this year. GM China plans to build 5 more plants next year and ramp up capacity by 65% by the year 2020 to 5 million vehicles. German carmaker BMW on Sunday unveiled a luxury concept sedan in Beijing called the Vision. It's aimed at a growing class of wealthy clients. The 5-meter-long vehicle boasts carbon fiber and lime wood, and it costs between $200,000 and $400,000 U.S. BMW says it sells about half of its upscale 7 Series cars in China, claiming current sales in double-digit growth. Rival Daimler has also experienced strong growth in the China market. Volkswagen established in eastern China in the 1980s, and it's the current top-selling foreign brand, moving westward with its luxury Audi models, targeting smaller mega-cities in the central and western provinces where vehicle density is currently lower. China's market is projected to expand between 8 and 10% this year, a slowdown from nearly the 14% growth in 2013, which totaled nearly 22 million vehicles. However, China's economy is slowing at a 7.4% rate in the first quarter, while more cities are restricting the number of cars on the road to ease congestion and pollution. Auto industry analyst Eric Harwit of the Hawaii-based East-West Center tells Daybreak Asia's Victor Beatty the Chinese auto market has exploded in recent decades.
It's really amazing just to think that 20 years ago or so, owning a car in China was really a distant dream for most people. But now you have a middle class of hundreds of millions of people who can afford to buy a car. Many cars cost more than they would cost in the United States and Europe, but still Chinese people have saved enough to buy those vehicles. It's really an amazing development for a developing country like China.
But at the same time, China is grappling with a slowing economy and also some environmental concerns. Air pollution is a big issue in China, particularly in its urban areas. How is that going to impact the auto industry?
The government has been saying for years that they want to try to do something about air pollution, but yet they can't give up the auto market. It gives people jobs. It generates tax income for the government. So they're kind of twisted between getting the air clean and making sure people can get the cars that they want to buy. Of course, traffic is a major problem, too, in the big cities.
How are authorities going to grapple with issues like the environment, given the growing auto industry?
Well, the government is trying to increase the air standard controls for the vehicles that they're selling. So they are becoming environmentally more friendly. They're trying to have them meet global standards for emissions, for example. Also, the government is trying to encourage electric vehicle markets and also hybrids. So I think that even though the growth of electric vehicles in China has been pretty slow up till now, I think we're going to see more and more of a push for people buying electric cars that are essentially pollution-free.
While Harwood sees the Chinese market remaining number one, it may not grow as fast as it has in the past, and that could pose a serious risk of overcapacity, even as many foreign carmakers ramp up production. Patrick Chovanec, chief strategist at New York's Silvercrest Asset Management and a former business professor in China, suggests China's auto market may already have peaked in double-digit annual growth and expansion will likely be slower.
A number of cities, Beijing, Shanghai, other cities are looking at it, placing limits on the number of license plates that are available. Beijing does it through a lottery system. Shanghai does it through charging very high prices to get a license plate. But either way, the main restriction on car demand in Beijing and Shanghai isn't the ability of people to afford it or the desire of people to own cars, but their ability to get their hands on a license plate. And that was instituted because of the terrible traffic problem and to try to rein that in or bring that under control. So that's one of the main challenges that the market faces in China.
Well, China's sales last year surged nearly 14%, almost 22 million vehicles sold just last year in China.
But, you know, interestingly enough, I mean, that is a decline from what the growth rate has been in past years and also what projections are. There's no question that China has one of the healthiest car markets in the world, but there are a lot of looming questions about how many more automobiles can the Chinese actually be able to put on the road without those roads being turning essentially into parking lots. You know, one of the things that's interesting is once you get outside of the main cities, you don't actually see that many people traveling on the highway from city to city. The traffic in China is almost all commuter traffic. It's not inner city travel. But once you get within the periphery of the city and you get into the center city, traffic problems become very intense. And so there's a big question mark over what kind of levels of car ownership can China actually be able to accommodate. You know, another interesting aspect of this is the competition between Chinese brands and foreign brands in the automobile market in China. China is a country where there are a lot of foreign automobile brands, but they all have to, the requirement is that they all have to be built in joint venture with domestic Chinese companies. And the idea originally was the Chinese government said, we will make them joint venture, there'll be technology transfer, and the foreign brands will essentially create their own competition because the Chinese brands will basically learn all that there is, get up to speed, and then they will be able to eclipse the foreign brands in the Chinese market. That hasn't happened. That hasn't panned out the way they planned, in large part because Chinese consumers really value the foreign brands. So while the manufacturing capability certainly exists in China, what's really valuable in the market is the foreign brand. And so there's some frustration, actually, in the Chinese automobile industry that it hasn't quite worked out the way that they planned, that they expected they would come to eclipse and dominate the market. And in fact, the foreign brands remain, although they're always in joint venture with Chinese companies, they remain really the dominant players in the automobile industry. Now, one of the interesting things that happened in the past year or so has been the government purchases a lot of cars, either directly or indirectly, for officials to drive it. And there has now been restrictions on local governments buying non-Chinese brands. So they're being channeled into buying Chinese-branded automobiles, which are considered kind of subpar, instead of the more prestigious foreign brands.
Chauvinec says China is exporting vehicles to the developing world such as Africa, but not the U.S. market, because Chinese manufacturers are not able to meet strict U.S. safety and emissions requirements. He says they were expected to years ago, but that remains an unfulfilled expectation. South Korea says it plans to push ahead next month with a UN Security Council presidential statement on preventing the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Seoul assumes the Security Council presidency in May. The South's ambassador to the United Nations, Oh Jun, said in an interview with VOA last week that preventing further provocations by North Korea will be his top priority during the UNSC presidency. Earlier this month, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown announced child marriage-free zones to be established in Pakistan. The UN Special Envoy on Global Education says the move is part of a global effort to end the practice and will try to keep Pakistani girls in school. Child marriage is widespread in Pakistan. In March, Pakistan Islamic Council demanded that the country abolish all legal restrictions on child marriage. Fortunately, there's a stronger movement from the girls themselves. The girls are banding together to refuse to be married off. Suzanne Petroni is a senior director of gender, population, and development at the International Center for Research on Women. She tells Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso there's a movement inside Pakistan working at the government level to end the practice of marrying off young girls too soon.
Child marriage is a problem that has been recognized by the global community, including by Pakistan, as one that needs to be eradicated. Pakistan is a signatory to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and a number of other international agreements that essentially outlaw child marriage. Religion is all too often used as an excuse to perpetuate this harmful practice. Child marriage is practiced worldwide in a number of countries. There are currently some 70 million girls under the age of 18 who are married. And so my hope is that the government will recognize that this is a harmful practice and they need to continue efforts to eradicate it, and that they have made many commitments to get rid of this violation of human rights.
What about other nations in the region, other Muslim countries in the region? How do you think the ripple effect it might have in their countries?
Bangladesh has child marriage prevalence rate more than twice as high as Pakistan. Their country has laws in place and policies intended to try to eradicate the practice. So there are examples of countries where religious leaders and governments have come together, recognized the harms that child marriage perpetuates, and have agreed to try to end it. And you see countries that have improved their economic development and their educational status for girls and have lower rates of child marriage. And these are very highly correlated. Girls who stay in school are less likely to be married, are less likely to be pregnant early, and are more likely to contribute to the economy of their countries. Many countries around the world, no matter their religion, have recognized this and are making efforts to enhance the equality of girls in their communities, the education for girls, and to stop child marriage.
What actually creates the change for governments and local entities to stop child marriage? What works?
In terms of what works at the community level, educating the girls and their parents and community members about the harms of child marriage and about the alternatives, that is, valuing girls in those communities, can help to raise from the community level on up awareness about the need to end child marriage. Another practice that we've seen through the evidence we've looked at is empowering girls themselves with information and with skills and with support networks to really ensure that they're equipped to understand the world and their options and advocate for themselves. And then finally, economic support and incentives for girls and their families to stay unmarried. In many cases, girls are married off by their families due to poverty. The family may not feel that they can feed another mouth, and so for them, giving the girl to another family and to marriage relieves that burden on them. In some cases, you still see dowry and bride price, which actually brings cash or a cow or a chicken to the family in exchange for the daughter. There is, unfortunately, no magic solution here that applies across communities across the world. We believe that child marriage can end in one generation. The solution really is value the girl, give girls greater opportunities to become educated, to engage in their communities and societies, improve gender equality broadly, and find ways to tackle the poverty that is leading many of the families to move their girls into a marriage.
Suzanne Petroni is the Senior Director of Gender, Population, and Development at the International Center for Research on Women. She was speaking with Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonzo. We invite you to stay tuned for the latest world news. It's next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.
The Beatles.
The presidential car coming up now. We know.